Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Does the end sometimes justify the means? For example, let's say your coworker is a lazy good-for-nothing who steals all the credit, but is a master manipulator and schmoozer, and so enjoys a great reputation at your expense. He or she knows that the company is laying people off, and so he does what he can to make you look bad, so you're the one who gets laid off. You, in contrast, are bright and hardworking and ethical, and all that's gotten you is on the possible layoff list. If you do get laid off, not only does the evil one get rewarded, the company's products or services are worse, because that person is a worse employee, and, of course, that means that customers are hurt, and indirectly, society is. So, is it cosmically just that you continue to play nicey-nicey? Or is there room for playing hardball? Or at minimum, should you know the various ways to play hardball so you're armed against the nefarious? Indeed, all of us are not always saintly. The classic book on how to arm and armor yourself is The 48 Laws of Power. Its author appeared on this show a couple months ago to talk about his new book, Mastery, Lessons from the Famous on How We Can Learn to Become Experts. But he was such a good guest, and his book is great, 48 Laws of Power, I decided to have him back to discuss that book. Robert Greene, welcome back to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, thank you for having me back, Marty.
My pleasure. Great. Well, now, it has been some years since you've written The 48 Laws of Power, and our filtering memory makes us remember the most important ones of the 48. So what would you say are, say, the three most important laws of power for us to remember, especially related to one's work life?
Well, you know, everything depends on people's circumstances, so it is a little bit difficult to do, but if I chose three, the first one is one that people sort of misinterpret by the title. It's called Learn to Keep People Dependent on You. Mm-hmm. It really is the most critical of them all for the workplace. And the idea is simple. Most people in the work world, they think that what's important is to get people to like them or to love them and to just have a nice friendly front and win in that way. But what happens is it's not an emotion that you can control, and just as easily as the boss or your peers might like you one day, they may turn against you the next day. The most important thing is that people need you. They don't have to necessarily like you, but they need you. And to fire you, to get rid of you, is too costly, is too difficult. You can't be replaced. And the problem that, you know, a lot of us have as we get older is that we are replaceable. There's somebody younger who could do the same job that we do for a lot less money, and they have more energy, et cetera. And at that point, we will be downsized or we become redundant. So you want to focus on the skills that you have and the things that you can do that make it so that it's absolutely impossible or very bloody or difficult to get rid of you. Thinking about people needing you as opposed to liking you.
Yeah. But isn't it really much harder, actually, to make yourself indispensable? There are very few people whose unique skill set is so unique and who are so capable that they make themselves indispensable, whereas it seems like it was, like, certainly one day a boss may like you more or less, but the reality is it seems to be easier to, you know, get people to let you suck up to them. You rarely disagree. You're rarely negative. You're low maintenance. I mean, that would seem more under one's control than being so good that in the whole 7.7 billion people on planet Earth, you are so indispensable they will keep you. Am I wrong?
Well, it's an ideal. You're never going to make it reach a point where you're absolutely so indispensable. Even I'm dispensable. Everybody at some point is to some degree dispensable. It's just you can't really control the fact that people like you. And really what is keeping you in your position is that they need you. They need you to do the work. And people confuse personal relationships with the work world. The work world, people are there to get a job done, not to have a little, you know, club of people who get along and have slap each other on the back and are friendly. So there are ways to make it. So if you focus from day one on making yourself indispensable, it kind of alters your strategy and how you approach the work world. You decide, well, it's important that I make allies in different branches of the company so that I have people spread around in different areas who I can work with, and I can then sort of get more skills and learn about other aspects of the company. There are ways to, there are strategies that you can, and I talk about it in that chapter, where you can make it so that you're less dispensable than you were.
Let me take a shot. Let me take a shot at trying to define what might make some a realistic way, a concrete way to make one indispensable. You may not ever be the smartest person there, or the greatest rock star computer programmer, but identifying something that is critical to your organization that is also requires institutional knowledge, and making a point, for example, of knowing all the rules for licensing teachers if you're working for a school district, and you know all the ins and outs, and you make the connections with the people in Sacramento so you can get exceptions, so you become the rock star in a micro niche that's critical. That would seem to be a realistic way, without having to turn an average person into a genius. By ultra specialization, you may be able to then survive the downsizings. Is that right?
That's one thing. Or you can actually do the opposite, where you have your, as I was saying earlier, you have your finger in so many different areas that you have a real feel for how the company works as a whole. And so you can come up with ideas that nobody else is thinking of. You not only, you know, commonly you will say, oh, I better have an ally with the person who works above me. But if you learn to mingle and spread yourself out a little bit and find allies in different departments who will have your back, and now you know how everything operates in general. You know, that was sort of like the Henry Kissinger strategy that I kind of map out in that particular law. It's mostly, it depends on what will make you indispensable in your particular circumstances. It could be specialization, or it could be, you know, having as many key allies as possible. It depends.
Fair enough. For those of you just joining us, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Robert Greene, the author of The 48 Laws of Power. And I asked them the question, it's been a few years or more than a few years now that since the book has been out, The 48 Laws of Power, and no 48 things are all equal in the world. So with the benefit of the filtration of time, I asked him, what are the three laws that end up being most either potent or non-obvious or critical, especially to one's work life? He shared one, which is the notion to keep people dependent on you, or at least your organization dependent on you. What's another of your top three, if you will?
Well, especially for the times that we're living in, I talk about concentrate your forces. It's sort of a more overall philosophical idea, which is we live in times where people are just so scattered and so dispersed, their attention spans are, you know, measured by several seconds instead of minutes. And we all are, you know, succumb to that. And it affects us in our work world and in generally. And we can't, you know, think in large blocks of time. And we try to, you know, do several things at the same point. Or we start a business, but the idea isn't very clear. And I want you to think that the power, this is a book about power, lies in concentrated energy. So the more deeply you focus on your idea, your business, the more you're able to close the door and not be distracted by your smartphone and actually think very deeply about a problem, the more you have a key ally who you know you've identified as a very important person to ally yourself with, I want you to concentrate your forces, concentrate your energy in whatever area that you're working in. So I find with the terrible distracting forces in the world today, that's a very key law.
It clearly makes sense. I mean, your other book, Mastery, does talk about how really successful people do make deep dives. But that in the real world, most people end up succumbing to one of two factors that keeps them from making a deep dive. They're dabblers. You reach a point of diminishing returns in learning about something, and so it's not as fun anymore after the first hour or week or year to learn to go yet deeper to becoming a rock star at something. So there's this dabbling tendency. And then there is this tremendous movement that is accelerating, ironically, in these ever more competitive times for work-life balance. So, you know, if you're really deep dive focused, you know, you're not stopping at 4:45 to go home for, you know, recreation or family. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's a misconception. And then, you know, there was a book, I don't necessarily totally agree with everything in it, but about the 4 hour week, I forget that's the title. By Tim Ferriss, we waste a lot of time. So if you know how to concentrate and manage your time well, you're going to be leaving at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. I know that in my own life. There's a lot of time wasters that I've gotten rid of, so I'm not working 7 days a week. The other thing is, I say in Mastery, if you choose a field that coincides to some degree with your loves and interests in life, if you do follow what I call your vocation, what you were meant to do, you're going to be able to focus more deeply, and the hours of practice and the tedium that's involved in becoming, as you say, a rock star won't bother you nearly as much. But, you know, not everything has to be pleasurable in life. To succeed, to do well at what you're doing, to become very skilled or an expert is going to require hours of drudgery. You know, we see with the rock stars or people who are successful, we only see the results of all of their hard work, and it gives us the illusion that they were just born that way. They were just born brilliant. But in fact, anybody who's good at something, if they're a great guitarist, they've spent hours practicing something that's just incredibly boring. And you have to be able to put up with that. And, our culture doesn't encourage that kind of thing. Everything must be instantaneously fun. And I want you to be able to go against that kind of trend and to close the door and be alone with yourself and think deeply about a problem and go as deep into it as possible, understanding that it's difficult, particularly in these times. But I think it's a critical, critical skill.
I could not agree more, 10,000%. People are not comfortable being uncomfortable, but achievement is almost never going to be instant gratification. It is. There is something, and the question that I constantly am obsessing with, I'm a career counselor, and I obsess about, is how to get people who are more pleasure-centric, who do like the, will seek the short-term pleasure in exchange for even if they don't have the long-term gain. Yeah. And it seems to me that it comes ultimately from a philosophical, foundational belief that productivity and societal contribution is the highest good, not pleasure. Do you buy that as the foundational assumption that needs to be made?
Yeah, and it's the key to my book, Mastery. I know we're talking about power book, but
it's fine.
I want to redefine your notion of pleasure, because it's hard for us as our nature is we're drawn to things that are fun and easy and pleasurable, and we are repelled by things that seem difficult and painful. So I want to redefine your notion of pleasure and pain. Getting instant gratification by a video game or something like that, in the end, is kind of a painful thing, because you're addicted to constantly having new things in your life, and can actually make you quite miserable. But in fact, spending 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years becoming great at a musical instrument or whatever your field is yields a level of pleasure that is far deeper than anything you can get from the quick little fixes that our culture offers. So I kind of want to completely readjust your whole attitude towards pleasure and pain.
People are often asking me, I'll be 64 years old in June, and I have written over 2,000 articles, 7 books. I continue to work 80 hours a week. and almost exclusively on self-help writing and seeing career counseling and personal coaching clients. And they say, why the hell do you are you still writing? Today, at this morning when I got up at 8 in the morning, I write for Psychology Today. And I wrote two articles today before I came to this radio show. Is it because it gives me more pleasure? No, it's not even a deeper pleasure. It is this cosmic sense that we all have a certain number of heartbeats on this planet and that it is wisest to spend them in the service of being productive. I could have watched TV. I could have lingered over coffee while savoring the Queen Amman that I love from Trader Joe's, but I decided to work my butt off this morning, not because it's pleasurable, because it feels like the right way to spend heartbeats. Any comments you want to make about that?
Well, I think that's extremely laudable, but I guess what I would say is it gives you a feeling of satisfaction. I'm sure it does. When you finish that article, now you can go back and look at all the books that you've written. You feel like you're doing something worthwhile. You're realizing your potential. You're not wasting your time. To me, that gives a level, maybe pleasure is the wrong word, it gives you a feeling of fulfillment.
Yeah, fulfillment's about right. The honest thing is, yes, I'll get a moment of pleasure, good, I got that done. But to be honest, the amount of pleasure, even at the deepest, yes, when I put my head on the pillow every night, I feel like I put in a good day. But those moments, it's really not the seeking of personal pleasure that is what drives me. And I know that sounds like holier than thou and all that crap, but I also rather be honest. It's not about pleasure. It's about doing, it's responsibility. It's a dirty word these days. I think since the 60s about, free love and play and whatever. The word responsibility and duty, D-U-T-Y, is a word that it seems is an atavistic word. And yet it's all about duty. It has nothing to do with pleasure. Is that what, any reaction to that?
Well, I feel my same way with writing. I feel like I have a mission in life that I was put on the planet for. I don't want to sound too New Agey there, but and it's to write the kind of books that I write.
Right.
And they involve just the most a lot of tedium, a lot of research, and my neck is killing me from all the books that I read. Mm. But I still maintain that overall, the feeling that I get from that is deeply, deeply satisfying. I can look back. I have these books, this work. I could die tomorrow, and I know that I've done what I feel like I wanted to do.
Right.
So maybe the word pleasure isn't right, but there's a level of satisfaction that if it wasn't there, I don't think I'd be able to do the kind of work that I do, because what would be the reward at all? Just a sort of a mechanistic sense of duty? No, there has to be something higher that kind of motivates you. There's Maslow's famous pyramid, a hierarchy of needs. There is that ultimate need that's higher than the other ones to fulfill something that you feel you were meant to fulfill.
Right. The one he calls self-actualization.
Yes.
Right. And so are you free to talk about what you're writing now?
Very much so. It's The Laws of Human Nature, and I'm basically looking at very deeply what I think are these sort of patterns that dominate our social behavior. Certain things that go back thousands, millions of years, and I want you to understand deeply this human animal that you deal with every day, so that you won't have all of these misunderstandings and conflicts and political situations that drive you crazy and give you gray hair, because you'll have a kind of a Zen understanding of what motivates people and how to ignore the bad stuff if it doesn't really affect you, and how to influence people if you need to, just a better understanding of the human animal.
Dude, you have an absolute invitation to reappear on the show when the book comes out.
Yeah.
Love to talk to you about that book. Sounds fabulous.
Okay, give me a couple years.
Yeah, okay. Time's ticking, dude. Why don't you be a little better time manager? Get it done in a year, would you?
Okay, I'll try.
All right. We were talking about, you had written the book, The 48 Laws of Power, and we're talking about what you think now with the passage of a few years, what you think are the three that you think are most critical for our listeners to hear about, especially as it pertains to their work life. We've talked about a couple. Tell us about the third.
Well, the third is the last chapter in the book, Assume Formlessness. And essentially the idea is, I think the people that really do the best in life are the ones that are fluid and adaptable. They can adjust. And in a career sense, you know, we're all having to adjust now. Nobody, like my father, works at the same job for 40 years like he did. Your career path is going to be scattered. There are going to be things where you work 3 years, 4 years here and there. And so the ability to adjust and let go of the past kind of recreate yourself and adapt your skills to what's happening in the world, in the present, and let go of past failures or things that are eating away at you, and be in the moment and be kind of fluid, is extremely important, I think, in this very chaotic work environment that we live in. So
definitely,
that would be my third law.
Letting go of the past, my God, we've all screwed up. Even the most successful people, you know, have screwed up many times, and in the end, resilience is so critical. You want to tell me a little bit about you? What did you start out doing career-wise? Where did you screw up? Give me a little, just a few of the signature moments in Robert Greene's life.
I have a lot of failures. I wanted to be a writer, so at least I knew that. But I tried journalism. Didn't really like it for various reasons.
Why?
At one point, an editor told me point blank that I wasn't a good writer.
I can't believe it. So an editor told me I wasn't a good writer, and since then I've had 2,000 articles and 7 books published. I can't believe it. Same thing. Continue.
Yeah, and you know that was a pretty painful moment. So I tried. I lived in Europe, and I wandered around trying to become the next Hemingway, and did all sorts of different jobs, but. Nothing ever quite came together, and nothing was published. I worked in film and Hollywood, which I really disliked.
Why?
And had quite a few failures there. And so really, by the time I was 36 years old, I had really nothing to my name, and my parents were quite worried about me. But I sort of knew that I was destined to be a writer, and when somebody asked me one day if I had an idea for a book, suddenly a little light bulb went on in my head, and I figured this was what I was meant to do. But the formlessness, the ability to adapt, for me, it meant every time I came up against something that didn't work, which was several times in my life, I didn't get despondent and depressed and suicidal. I decided, all right, I got to try something else, and see if that works. And eventually I'm going to find my way.
Yep.
So, you know, if I hadn't tried all of these different things in my own career, I would have never been able to write the 48 Laws of Power, because I was able to draw on all of these awful power experiences that I had lived through in my life and all these different jobs. So, you know, I think in some ways I kind of embody that law.
A couple of things. Most people aspire to if they're a writer, the Hollywood is the holy grail. My God, I want to write a screenplay. You know, it seems like, you know, you go into a taxi. I remember one time I went into a taxi cab, and just for the fun of it, I asked, how's your screenplay coming? How'd you know I was writing a screenplay? Because everybody's writing a screenplay. So why did you hate Hollywood?
Well, I hated it because, for various reasons, I hate the kind of falseness that prevails, where everybody pretends that it's about film and art and culture, but it's really all about power, and people are obsessed with power, and they do all kinds of very manipulative things, stuff that inspired a lot of the 48 laws, but nobody's honest about it. So I found it an unpleasant environment that way. But as a writer, you have an idea and you think it's great, and then they love it, and then suddenly it's bought, and now 5 new people come in and change every word and every idea that you have. And by the time it comes out, it's like a sausage factory. It doesn't resemble the meat that first went in there. And so, you know, I like to control what I do. I like to have
me too.
Because it gets mediocre as more and more people get involved
right.
in the process. So I realized from that experience I need to be writing, doing something that I'm the main man, I can control, and I don't have all of these people meddling with what I do.
Yep. Decision-making by committee is always going to be a formula for reduction to the lowest common denominator, whether it be in writing, in corporate America. We read today hegemonic in corporate America is the notion of, you know, no top-down, collaborative, buy-in, teamwork. And in the end, you know, weak employees love it because then they don't have to shoulder so much of the burden. But bright employees despise it because they end up having to sit through endless meetings to get buy-in. And the only thing you can get buy-in from everybody is the lowest common denominator. It's damn crazy. I was almost going to say F crazy, but I realized I'm on the radio. Anyway, you know, you talk, you know, it's easy for us to agree, yes, we need to be flexible and adapt and change, but it's one thing to be a self-employed writer and adapt to your writing style, but employers in the real world, because in these tight times there are zillion applicants for every job, they would much rather take somebody who doesn't have to adapt but who has done the exact micro work previously. And so society today is not rewarding adaptation. What do you say to the more typical worker who's got X skill set and now he or she wants to adapt? How do you convince an employer to say yes to an adaptation?
Well, you know, I guess the problem here is a lot of my books and ideas are geared more towards the entrepreneurial mindset. So, you know, if your goal is, if you're working at AT&T and that's where you're at and that's the job that you're after, maybe having a resume like the one that I had would be an absolute, you know, disaster. Wouldn't look good at all. So I understand that. I'm talking about from the employee point of view, you yourself, your mindset. You have to think about yourself, and you have to have a degree of autonomy where you've got your own career and you've got to kind of create it for yourself. And so you're not going to, if you have that, you're applying for a job at AT&T or whatever that is, and you have the right skill sets, I'm saying in your mind you're thinking, I'm not going to be at this job for 4, 5, 10 years. I don't want to be working at this desk and dealing with these people for that much of time. So what is my plan for my next step in life? Things are going to be changing. This job that looks so great now, because I've got the skills that match it, they'll fire me tomorrow if it suits their interest. So I want the person who's listening to me now to have an adaptable spirit, to say that nothing is going to last. They might hire me today, but they'll get rid of me tomorrow. So where am I going to be tomorrow? How can I be fluid and adaptable and think of the next step in my life? Maybe this particular bit of technology and place that I'm working for won't exist in 5 years. You know, I'm working at a VHS company making video cassette recorders, and then now they're all gone. And what's my career? That might be happening to you right now. I want you to have a spirit where you're going to let go of things. You're not tied to the past. You're not tied to the skills that you had, and you're not going to be looking for the same job over and over and over again. It's more about that.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Robert Greene, the author of The 48 Laws of Power. And I think I now want to go turn to you, my dear listeners. If you have a question or a comment about power that is either being taken from you or that you would like to get, we invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's, again, I know you're in the entrepreneurial mindset, but because so many of my listeners are in organizations, I think it's important to ask you this question. Let's say you were hired on a new job as a manager or an executive, whether it's a for-profit or a non-profit or government agency. Would you implement any of the 48 laws of power preemptively to both maximize the positive impact you're going to have and neutralize potential sources of unfair opposition?
Well, but they're more kind of general things. They're not like particular little tricks that I would think of. So there's a law in there about don't isolate yourself in a fortress. You want to be have as many open channels of communication as possible. So if you're a leader of some sort and you're hired in a managerial or executive role, I want you not to be operating behind your door. I want you to have as many people out there that you're in constant communication with, You're listening to everyone. Your door is open. Because if not, cliques and little groups of people and factions are going to be forming, and you're not going to be knowing what's going on in the company. So from day one, I want you to establish really, really open channels of communication, so you're aware of everything that's going on. I want you to work on the hearts and minds of people, so you know you're not alienating those you're working with. You have a spirit where I call, you know, leading from the front, where people see you working as hard as everybody else. So you sort of create this kind of esprit de corps where everybody wants to be doing the same as you. They want to be seen as working hard. You kind of set the tone in that way. I want you to create this, what I call create compelling spectacles. The major problem that people have in large organizations these days is it's so factionalized and political, and it's hard to get everybody on the same page. We don't really have any myths or large things that connect people together like religion used to do, or a cause. And I find the companies that seem to function best, people feel like they're not just working for a paycheck. They're working for something bigger than that, something a little bit more important. Whatever that cause can be, it could be having to do with the environment. It could be I don't know what it is. I was just recently reading Phil Jackson's autobiography called 11 Rings, and he made the players feel that they were the only team playing the real kind of basketball, team basketball. So it was like a cause that they were all working towards. So I want you to do something like that, where you unite people in a spirit sort of sense, but we're all on the same page, so you can kind of avoid that factionalizing stuff. Those would be some of the laws. I mean, I could talk all day about this.
Let's go to the phone. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Robert Green, the author of The 48 Laws of Power. What's your question or comment for him? Hi, it's you.
It's me?
It is.
Okay, yep, hi. I work as a manager in Silicon Valley, and somebody came to me recently complaining about the demands of other members of our company, and I pointed out something that I think is relevant to this conversation to that person. Change is hard to deal with when it's being imposed on you, but if you can step back and look at the direction that your group or your company or your industry is heading and sort of become the driver of what you think needs to happen as time marches forward, it becomes a lot easier and a lot less stressful for you personally.
Yeah, that's very much what I'm saying. It's sort of your mindset, and if you're the one thinking ahead, and it's not something that's happening to you, but you're sort of in some ways controlling it a bit. I know recently, from my own experience as a writer of books, it takes like 2 or 3 years for my books to come out. So oftentimes when they come out, the whole landscape has changed, where marketing the book is no longer what it was because of the internet or something new. And I know that if I hold on to what I was working a couple of years ago, or if I got complaining or felt negative about this, or I felt sort of like I was at the mercy of all of these changes going on, it would really, really slow me down and make it hard for me to operate in this environment. So I have the attitude of I'm understand that it's a totally new world out there than it was just 3 years ago, and so I'm going to be ahead of the game, and I'm going to figure out how I have to market in a totally different way. And this time from my last book, it was all about using the internet and blogs and people with the right kind of blogs and podcasts, et cetera, something that just didn't exist in 09. So it's up to me to have that adaptable spirit as opposed to just having things imposed on me and complaining and whining about it.
Yeah, and Cole, I really like the idea that whether you're a clerk or you're a CEO, thinking like a CEO, yes, you're not always going to be able to act on it. If you're going to be seen too much as a stuff disturber, they may just get sick and tired of, you know, their bosses are overwhelmed. But at least in your own, as a thought experiment, constantly thinking about, if I were the CEO, what would I do? And then judiciously deciding what to bring up is probably a good idea. I want to thank you for the call, because all our lines are lighted up. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with Robert Green, the author of The 48 Laws of Power. What What's your question or comment for him? Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
I like certain aspects of my work, but many aspects of my work lead to tedium and frustration, which leads to procrastination and worry about the future.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering how I can change my outlook or rewire my brain so my self-actualization or a sense of duty overcomes the tedium, frustration, and procrastination. And how can I let go of the tedium, frustration, and procrastination so I'm living in the moment instead of worrying about the future?
Right.
And so I want to try to adapt my spirit to that.
Robert, do you want to take that? Because we discussed this before.
I mean,
go ahead.
We said earlier that everything is going to involve some amount of tedium, and you have to be putting up with it, but there are levels. And I've noticed that this is something I talked about in Mastery, that if there's not a degree of challenge in your life to the work, if there's not something new that you have to do, it's very hard to draw the energy and the excitement. The brain doesn't function unless we feel the need, the absolute need to get something done. We have to learn something. We have to write something, create something. And if there's no urgency, then you're just going to be overwhelmed by the tedium and you're going to be procrastinating, et cetera. So I want you to look for some new challenge. There's some new skill. It sounds like you're sort of in a rut and the work has become very repetitive. I want you to find something new that you had, not on a grand scale. I don't want you to quit your job and become a poet. I just mean something on a small degree. Here's a new skill that I want to master. Here's a new project that I want to try and suggest. Something where you're going to feel a challenge, where you have to rise to the occasion. It's going to involve a new set of tedium where you're maybe going to have to find some new skills, etc. But it sounds like you're bored and your brain isn't engaged and it's kind of slowly circling down the drain that way.
Caller, rather than deal in the abstract, why don't you tell me about what your job is, the specifics, and what is tedious about it, and let's see if we can be more specific in terms of either see if this job is salvageable or whether you really do need to leave.
Okay. Well, basically it's a software job, and it's dealing with some code that's very tedium. Tens of thousands of lines of code that are easy to get lost in, basically, is what it is.
And there are two. If you are very viable in the workplace, you may not need to accept that tedium. If you went and started a job search now and made as the absolute sine qua non of the next job you were to take, one that it was more often stimulating, would you be relatively hireable? And I'm not asking you to quit your job, but to start searching now, or is your viability so suspect that you probably need to have an attitude adjustment and realize that doing that tedium is great, actually ultimately a great service to the user of the software?
Yeah, I think I would require some retraining to go into a different programming set of skills. And at this point, I'm not sure that that's what I really want to do.
Okay, so two choices. So is it either a radical career? It sounds like you don't want to learn any more programming stuff. You really only have three choices. One is to allow yourself continued misery. Two is to have that cosmic attitude adjustment to say, even if it's tedious, the fact that it is tedious means many people wouldn't do it, and by my doing it, I am going to be serving a larger good. Or do you need to make a radical career change?
I think it's one of the latter two, and I haven't come to a conclusion on that yet.
Let's play a little bit, if you don't mind. And Robert, I'm going to just take charge for a minute or two here because it's my little thing. I do these 3-minute workovers.
Sure.
So I want you to let's pretend that our goal here in the next few minutes is to come up with a new idea for a radical career change for you. So at least it'll give you something to mull over and decide whether indeed it's worth the pain of making a career change or not. Tell me a few things about yourself that will give me clues so that I can propose some alternatives that may be helpful to you.
Okay. I was thinking of getting out of programming maybe and going into something more involving research, possibly, or using my programming skills to do some research in some type.
What kind of research? Are we talking about quantitative? Is there a particular field? What kind of research?
Well, one thing that's always fascinating me is to research things like inefficiency in government, waste, corruption, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking if I could use some of my database skills to mm-hmm. uncover something in that area.
Absolutely. I happen to know of an organization. I remember now this guy dropped out of Stanford just a couple of years ago. He said he can't stand all the waste of taxpayer money and government, and he created this website that documents all kinds of stuff like that. I'm sure that if I happen to have heard of that just in the course of my client interactions, what if I said, I want you to get off the phone, I want you to make a list of 5 or 10 so that there's, you have some chance of one of them responding to you, 5 or 10 organizations that are government watchdog groups that are waste and efficiency oriented. Find somebody who is a director of research there or some such title. Email him. Tell him what your skill set is. Say that you're feeling like your work is humdrum and meaningless and that you would find it very useful to be a researcher, perhaps a big data, analyst kind of person. And are you delusional? It's a word I love to use. Are you being delusional to think that you can make a transition? By sending 5 or 10 of those emails, the chances are pretty good that one of them will and either tell you are delusional or outline the pathway by which you might make that change. How does that feel as a homework assignment?
I think that's good.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for the call because all our lines are lighted up. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Martin Amco. My guest, Robert Greene, the author of The 48 Laws of Power. What is your question or comment for him?
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
My question, he was commenting on making yourself needed as opposed to liked. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really insightful, but there's a kind of a flip side to that is in an organization I have worked for, the entry-level positions are very important to the organization. Mm-hmm. All of the revenue comes through the entry-level position people, and the people that are really excel at that job often don't get promoted to other positions mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. they're so necessary mm-hmm. because they provide such an important service to the organization.
Right.
And so what I see happening is people kind of failing upward, where rather than getting rid of the people who aren't excelling at the entry-level positions, making them part of the administration, and then therefore, once they're part of the administration, they then get management opportunities and stuff like that down the line. And it seems like I'm more concerned at it from how do you make the case to the people who are running an organization, running a company, that this kind of structure is not advantageous because you get a layer of management who aren't successful at doing the job of the people they're managing, and therefore may not be able to give them the tools they need to be even more successful than they already are. So I'm wondering how to address that in the workplace. How do you make the case? How do you change that structure? If you're just concerned about the health and well-being of the company.
Anything to say, Robert, there?
I didn't really follow it, Marty. I'll let you take that one.
Yeah. The problem is that many times people are self-serving. And so the best, I think, it's very difficult to change an overall organizational structure. But if your goal is to take people who are, for example, these frontline workers and turn them into people who are ethical, wise stewards of the whole company, that seems to be both a selection and a training issue. There are some people who may be great salespeople at the front line, but who are terrible in looking at the big picture and managing and budget and whatever. So I think the best way to respond to this is to find the one human being in your organization who seems to be more circumspect. And talk to him or her, not in an accusatory way, but say, I'm wondering whether we have a real bottleneck between the real bottleneck in our organization growing is there seems to be a kind of almost a nefarious path between what is ideal for the organization and what ends up being expedient for the organization. Is there one person that you should be talking with?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to find that one person. So,
well, I would take, rather than do nothing, I would take a shot. It's just a probabilistic issue. So I would look at all the people in your organization and see if, in fact, there is somebody who you should at least, you know, I wouldn't say bare your soul, you know, you could, it could come back to bite you, but test the waters, the little comment about how are you feeling about the way in which people are hired and promoted here? Does it feel like a felicitous, a helpful approach? Or, you could, what, you know, when you go home at night and you think about things, what kind of changes do you see making? And so see how he reacts to that, if it's defensive or open, and maybe that will open the door to an important conversation. What do you think?
Well, what about the one idea I've been thinking of is making a letter of recommendation for colleagues to be promoted.
Good.
So suggesting that a colleague who's on the front lines, who is seems to be someone that could be a good manager that has the skill set, that person should be like a letter of recommendation to one of these types of people that you're referring to.
Yep, I like it very much. Sometimes the caller's ideas are better than my own, so especially since you're more invested in it, go for it. But if that doesn't work, then maybe try to search out somebody you might collaborate with and try to come up with smarter schemes for promotion. Anyway, thanks very much for the call. Of course, that's the, you know, very often there is the Peter principle at work where people get promoted to their level of incompetency. You know, before we go back to the phones and the lines continue to stay all lighted up, you know, a number of your laws, and we talked about it earlier today, Robert Green, is, you know, many of them are not nefarious, really. They exist in any self-help book, you know. Win through your actions, not through argument. Concentrate your forces, like you said earlier. Enter action with boldness. Guard your reputation. Say less than necessary. When asking for help, don't ask for mercy. Appeal to their self-interest. Focus on the reality of power, not its trappings like fancy houses or cars or clothes. There is, though, there are some that really do rankle most people. For example, let others do the work but take the credit. Is there any way you can ethically defend that? Or is that just something to arm yourself against the nefarious?
Well, you know, let's understand the context of which this book was written. I was really, I had seen in all of my different jobs a lot of manipulation going on. I think all of us worked who are past the age of 40, for instance, we've accumulated these experiences. And the self-help books out there that explain the work world are not realistic about how things really operate, particularly on executive levels, but even lower down the ladder. So I wanted to counteract that. I wanted to say, this is what really goes on in the world. This is how power really operates. Now, it's up to you, the reader, that I'm treating as an adult, to decide, well, that's ugly, I hate that, you know, sort of thing, and not sort of preach to you. Now, get others to do the work, but always take the credit. That has been my experience in so many places that I've worked in, particularly in Hollywood, where I wrote something and somebody else put their name on it. You know, a president gives a speech, but he didn't write it. You see a newscaster on television, he didn't do the research. It's not his ideas that he's saying. On and on down the line. And so I wanted to address that in a realistic way and say, this is the reality of the work world. You better understand it and not be naive.
Absolutely.
And the mistake I had made in my life was I reacted personally and emotionally. I took it as like an affront.
Yep.
And so that chapter is about don't do that. That's wrong. This is the reality. Accept it and find a way to make it work for you, which is what I eventually, you know, did in writing my book.
Yep.
So I just wanted to give it to the reader straight without all of the namby-pamby preaching or saying that, you know, we shouldn't be like that. I just wanted to give it to you straight.
Yeah, and you've got others like that, too. Pose as a friend, work as a spy. There are a lot of people who do that, you know, whether you do it or not. But certainly, you know, and I got to tell you, I used to think that while people had different approaches to life, they were all in their own individual way trying to do the right thing. But I have since, you know, in my own professional life, I'm a critic of higher education, especially in terms of their ability to add value to undergraduate students. Man, there is a professor who reads my stuff, and he stays. And of course, when you post comments on blogs, you can be anonymous. Who will deliberately lie about my background to destroy the credibility of my work? People will do whatever it takes. I have I have some very, very good Yelp reviews, but one of my colleagues told me that she had gotten together with a bunch of people who work at a career center, and a couple of them are jealous of me, and they got together and got drunk and pretended to be clients of mine. Some of them had come and visited me. I invite clients all the time to watch me work, so they know all the details of how I work, and they pretended to be my clients and wrote nefarious, completely devastating Yelp reviews just to make me look bad. Not everybody is well-intentioned.
Wow, that's particularly in the internet world where people can do things and be anonymous. It's kind of made it. My laws are even more relevant than ever before.
Absolutely. I want to tell you about one more evil trick, and then I see how you respond. You know, I do deep dives into my hobbies, and I did a deep dive a decade or so ago into rose hybridizing, and I ended up learning about this story. You would think if there was ever an industry that was filled with peace, love, and goodwill, it would be the flower industry. Well, there was this guy who had spent a decade, maybe more than a decade, developing a thornless rose, a rose that didn't have thorns. And he went and he had this fabulous plant, and he found a professional grower to make lots and lots of cuttings, and you need thousands of plants before you can make it commercial. It took a few years. Well, a couple of years after he gave this treasured plant to this guy down in Wasco, California, down in the Central Valley, the guy whose name was Harvey Davidson, he was the guy who developed the thornless rose, drove down to look at his plants. And the grower said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. We had a fire and all your plants were destroyed." And the guy was despondent. He had all these decades of work. And he says, before he turned back from Wasco to come back to Orinda where he lived, he drove down the road to get something to eat. And all of a sudden, he saw a huge field of his roses alive and well.
Wow.
If it weren't for the luck of him driving past the roses in a place he never would have known about, he would have been screwed. Is there any advice about what a guy can do, or a woman, of course, can do to prevent these truly kind of nefarious things?
Well, yes. It's really up to you. And I would, if it would happen to me, I would reassess and say, where did I go wrong? And everybody has a track record. So before you're going to, and people steal ideas left, right, and center. And so before you entrust your thornless rose to a person, you have to investigate them and see their character. Character is the most important thing to assess. And everybody has a track record. And if they don't have a track record, you don't want to work with them. So you want to find out, does this guy have anything? You want to test him as much as possible, but you also want to look into his past, see how what it was like for other people to work with him. You can bet. I'd almost bet, $1,000 that this person has done something similar to someone else before the thornless rose incident.
Yeah.
And if you can't get any information on that person, then don't go anywhere near them.
You know, most corporations have a policy, though, no references, because they're afraid of getting sued. If it's a positive reference and the person turns out to be a bad employee, they sue the company. If it's a negative reference, the employee then sues. So, you know, it is hard. I'm trying to now be the you try to be in the book, realistic instead of the nicey-nicey talk that tends to pervade public radio. In the real world of how people function, not how we wish they function, you know, there is a lot of bad behavior that goes on. All these, how many employee lawsuits that are not real, but they figure company's got deep pockets. I'm going to go after the company. Do you have any broad statements about humankind? And I'm noticing, for example, as I drive down the road, that when I try to change lanes, it seems ever more often they speed up to cut me off. And it seems to me that's a reasonable index of society's kindness, because they have nothing to gain or lose by cutting. But speeding up, are you finding that society is getting tougher to trust or easier to trust, or don't know opinion?
I would, my opinion is something that I'm writing about in my next book, is it's pretty much the same as it's been for thousands and thousands of years. This is sort of what the human animal is like. And it can almost be a percentage where we could say 5 to 10%. You might want to raise it depending on your circumstances. 5 to 10% of the people out there are sociopaths, psychopaths, narcissists, have very little social interest, They don't have a great degree of thinking about other people. A lot of times they rise to positions of power because of that particular makeup, of psychological makeup, or they're driving out there in this particularly obnoxious way. And it seems like there's more of them out there, but they're getting a lot of attention. And so it's deeply embedded, I think, this notion of wanting to take from other people without having any kind of consequence. There are people out there like that who will steal ideas, who will take as much as they can if there aren't laws in place or somebody isn't watching. So if I'm the guy with the thornless rose, I'm entering in there. I think he was naive, and I'm entering into this saying, the chances are that if I entrust this to someone, they're going to steal it. So knowing that, I'm going to be much more careful with who I work with. And if I'm going to take five people that I'm choosing from, if there are five people, and three of them I can't get any information on because of what you mentioned, two of them I can, well, I'll look at least at the two, and I'm going to do more research. People don't do enough research. They hire their friend or their brother because it's easy, not thinking very deeply about it. They chose the easy route. You need to do, before you make such an important decision about partnering with a person, you need to thoroughly vet them. So, you know, it's being realistic about the fact that there are people out there who are manipulative or who are downright evil, and you have to be careful about it. Not paranoid, but careful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what, you know, I'm not a big fan of government regulations. I believe government's grown too big, but it's because that, you know, for example, drug companies, if without an EPA, without an FDA to require a lot of, you know, proof of the efficacy and safety of their drugs, I think companies would prematurely, in their greed, bring more products to market. I think companies corporations would pollute rather than meet all the environmental regulations. So we need an EPA because, unfortunately, we can't trust. We're just about out of time, but I want to take one more, see if I can take... Nah, we don't have time. So what I'd like to do is give you the last word. What's one more thing that we haven't discussed yet related to the 48 Laws of Power that you might want to share with our listeners so that that might empower them, especially around work, the workplace?
Well, you know, the main thing is that whenever you get in a place where there are three people working, there's politics and egos and insecurities and battles that are going on. And I want to kind of change your mental outlook about them, your whole way of relating to the work world. I want to create a revolution in your head, which is, I don't want you to take things personally. It's like a game of chess. And if someone does a great move and checkmates you, you don't get angry and like try and hit them. You just say, wow, that was really well done. Well, people are moving on that chessboard. They're doing things that you may not like, but this is just the power game as it is. And if you start taking everything personal and emotional, it's like you're giving other people a double victory over you, because now you're spending days and weeks and months obsessing over what somebody did you here, et cetera, and you're losing valuable time. So I want to sort of adjust your whole way of looking at the work world and have some distance from it and not get so emotional and personally involved in everything that happens. So if there are setbacks, instead of looking at the other person and getting all blaming and whining, you look at yourself and see, this is what I could have done differently, as we, you know, as I said with the man with the thornless rose. So that's the overall philosophy of the book, is the less emotional that you can take this, the more you can have some distance, the more you can watch people's maneuvers and not listen to the words they say. You know, look at it as these are the actions that reveal who they are, and not you know, giving credence to what they say about themselves. It's just a sort of an overall philosophy that I think will save you all of that mental anguish and waste of time that a lot of people go through because of these
these games that people play.
That is really good advice, and frankly, it's one I need to take myself. Things can eat me up that way. I want to thank you, Robert Greene, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. The book is The 48 Laws of Power. He's also got a great book called Mastery, and I look forward to his next book, which is The 48 Laws or whatever of Human Nature, and that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. Thanks again, Robert.
Thank you very much.
And my thanks to my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday, 11, special show. Former U.S. Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. We will talk mainly about how to create jobs, but also about the minimum wage, unions, regulation, the effect of employer mandates on jobs, and I'll ask him about his life from childhood on. And we're going to especially look for lessons that we might apply to our own work lives. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.